Welcome to Modern Sign Books. If you're interested in what makes your favorite authors tick, then you'll love hearing what they have to say in our interviews. Learn how they got started writing, the books and authors that inspired them, and much more. Meet today's hottest authors as they discuss their lives and writing with art book specialist, Roger Nichols. And don't forget to pick up a copy of your favorite books at bjbooks.com. Here's Roger.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Alan Jacobson is an award-winning, best-selling author of mystery, suspense, thriller novels, including the FBI Profiler Karen Vale series and the OPSIG Team Black Covert Ops novels, as well as standalone books and short stories. Now, most of us have a series of pivotal moments we look back on and see how they've influenced where we are today. Alan Jacobson has a number of such turning points that he's shared with us, including an experiment in forced busing at his New York Junior High that was a horrible failure, but gave him the opportunity to have the same superb teacher for all the years of junior high school. Another came when he was a practicing chiropractor, injured his wrist to the point he had to sell his practice, and, thank goodness, turned to writing. And another was when he met, well, one of his best friends, a Mark Safarik, FBI agent, who gave him, opened up world of insights to him that made some of his writings really add that substance to it. So we are very delighted to talk about his latest book, coming up, and we have with us today the wonderful Alan Jacobson. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Roger. Thanks for that wonderful intro.
Well, it's easy. I just try not to drool on the microphone and my fanboy hat here as we go on. I was just interesting. I'm going back through some of the interviews that I've done because I'm getting ready to write a book about all these people that I've talked to, and I noticed that Lee Child and Sandra Brown both were fired from jobs in television that started their writing careers, and you weren't fired, but you had a situation that forced you to leave your other job. And in retrospect, though it must have been a really tough time at the time, it was a very good thing for the rest of us.
Well, it was really tough, actually, and I didn't realize the subconscious part of the mental aspect of losing one's career. Many years before, you expect that to happen. Mm-hmm. And I was having these unusual symptoms. I had difficulty remembering phone numbers, which was bizarre for me because I was able to remember everybody's phone number. I would just pick up the phone and dial. I never thought twice about it until suddenly I couldn't do that. And almost simultaneously, I was getting dizzy. So, you know, back in my prior career, which I had just left at the time, I started self-diagnosing, which you should never, ever, ever do. But we all do it as doctors, and I did it. And I said, oh, my God, I've got a brain tumor. And so I went over to a neurologist friend of mine who I'd worked with in practice, and he examined me, and he said, look, I don't think you have a brain tumor, but we're going to do an MRI of your brain just to put your mind at ease. He said, I think I know what's going on. Uh-huh. The MRI came back normal, and he said, basically, you're going through, and I wish I could remember the exact term, but it was something to do with occupational depression, where when you lose your career and it wasn't your choice, we go through a period of mourning and depression, and he said, that's what's going on here, and it'll self-resolve in, a couple months. And he was right. It did. It went away. That kind of showed me at a base level just how difficult it was for me to change careers. But at the same time, I was fortunate because I loved writing. And as you said, I got my degree. I think you said this. I got my degree in it. Mm-hmm. But I did have a tremendous teacher in the 7th and 9th grades. I had him for 2 years. And he basically showed me the beauty of English, and that's when I started realizing when I went to college, this is what I want to get my degree in. So I was very fortunate, have been very fortunate to have two careers that I absolutely loved, and, some people search for one career that they love, so I do feel fortunate.
I have to ask this because it always intrigues me, the moments when things change. When did you know that you really were a writer? What was the magic moment for you?
That is an awesome question that I've never been asked. I think probably it would have to go back to my college years in terms of just knowing that I loved writing. And it was, you know, I was taking all these courses, short story workshop, playwriting workshop, fiction workshop. I loved going to class. I loved sitting down at the typewriter, because back then it was a typewriter, and composing and losing myself in the world and the characters. And I ended up writing, I think my first really major project on my own that was not for school was writing MASH scripts, the TV series MASH. I loved it. I was a big fan. And I just decided I was going to write some episodes. Yeah. And I did. I wrote 7 episodes. And there was one in particular that I thought was outstanding. And we, long story short, I ended up getting an agent at William Morris in New York City. And he was trying to sell it cross-country, which was kind of a tough scenario back then. And we ended up getting it to Alan Alda's agent and through back channels. And he got it. And I have a letter from him on MASH stationery. I still have it. And anyway, the long story short is that was probably the first time I had started writing something that was not a school assignment, just for the fun of it. And I had such great fun from doing it, and a sense of accomplishment when completing it, and knowing that I had created this, that was probably the moment. That was a long, long time ago. In a galaxy far away.
Well, those are the magic moments, though, that teach us who we are, and we hold on to those like beads on a necklace. Those are the things that are touchstones, he says, mixing metaphors crazily. But they do. Thank you. We should probably talk about The Dark Side of the Moon, which is kind of the excuse for us having a chance to get together and chat again. And I want to say that as I was reading this, I had the solipsistic notion that had been custom written just for me, because I am a huge longtime science fiction fan. I like near future, and I love spy adventure mystery. And here it is, wrapped up in one fantastic package. It has Opsig Team Black. It has Karen Vale. It has, oh my gosh, twists and turns. So I want to thank you for writing my personal book there for me.
I aim to please.
you do indeed. But what was the impetus for moving off Earth for this?
So it's funny that you should ask that. About an hour ago, I was talking to a Barnes & Noble manager about this very same question. Mm-hmm. So the impetus was very much like Inmate 1577, which was Karen Vale number 4. I was not planning to write it at all. And this idea popped into my head, and I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And each day, I would write more in the outline, and each day, I would get more and more excited about it, until finally I said, I've got to write this book. And that's pretty much what happened with Dark Side of the Moon. I had seen a news piece about new, previously unreleased photos from Apollo 17, and I started paging through the photos on this gallery on NASA's website, and there were captions that accompanied each photo so that you know what you're looking at. And I was just, you know, enraptured by it took me back to my childhood and relived the Apollo days. Right. And I was pretty young back then, but I do remember it. And so I'm looking at these photos from the moon and from the lunar module and the moonwalks that they did. And then I was reading the caption, and I saw this one caption that said something about material that the astronauts brought back from their mission back to Earth and had some surprising results from what they found in the material. And I, it just, the light snapped on and I started brainstorming and writing up the outline at right at that time. And each day I couldn't stop thinking about it. And, you know, I've been writing long enough now, over 20 years, to know that when that happens, you got to follow your passion and see where it takes you.
Oh, yeah.
And I just kept adding to the outline. And I said, I have to write this book. I just got too excited about it to put it in a drawer and say, well, figuratively in a drawer. Now we store it on our hard drives. But,
yeah.
You know, to put it in a drawer and say, yeah, someday I'll write that, because I have a lot of those. And a lot of those I really want to write, but this is one of those that I just had to write now. I just had to do it. And so that's how it came about. And I really thought it would be a relatively easy thing to research. And I remember saying that to my wife, or rather, she doesn't let me forget that I said that to her, because it was the stupidest thing I possibly could have said. And because the research was incredibly difficult, incredibly. It was, and I say this about each one of my books, that it was so difficult to research, but this one was extraordinarily so, because it was out of this world, literally.
Well, yes, and in fact, that leads me to my next question, which was going to be, I know how much research you do, and this must have been a whole other level of that, because you have contacts and people you developed in dealing with the people who work in intelligence and whatnot, but this is a whole different category to be working with. So again, you probably had to start over.
You hit the nail on the head, Roger. That's exactly right. And that was the problem I was faced with as I started to get into the outline. And that's when I set up what I need to research and who I need to speak with and how I'm going to get the information. And it was that point when I said, oh no, I don't have any contacts in this realm at all. And when I started to look into it, I realized that it is a kind of a closed world. You're dealing with engineers and, I mean, literally rocket scientists, and they're different individuals, just like, you know, every field of expert information and technology, you know, we all have our differences as a group. You know, engineers tend to think in a very orderly, planned way, a structured way, and I have friends who are engineers, and it's, you know, we've had this discussion in the past, and so you have to kind of understand the world you're getting into and the people that you're approaching and what their mindset is. And they're not used to working with others outside their field. And it was difficult finding people who could speak in about their very, very complex topic in a way that a non-engineer and rocket scientist can understand. And as I started to get into it, I realized that this is going to be very difficult, not just in finding the people, but in understanding the concepts, because I'm not a rocket scientist. And, you know, I knew about as much about a moonshot, the moon, rocketry, as the average person does, which is not a whole lot. I mean, we know of it. We know some basic principles, and that's it. And to write a book believably, you need to have a global understanding of what's involved so that you could then plot what's going to happen. Because a lot of times what happens in the story, those twists and turns that you mentioned earlier, they come from the situation that the characters find themselves in and the mechanics of where they are and the things that can happen. And where you are on the moon and the things that can happen are very different from what can happen and the properties of living on Earth, as you would imagine. But even something as simple as constructing scenes with people who are, let's say, your enemies, okay, your antagonists, you can't do that on the moon because you can't speak to somebody. They're in their own spacesuit on a different radio frequency. So suddenly you realize that if you have a confrontational scene, you have to construct it completely differently. So as a writer, it was a challenge to understand what can be done, what the limits are, what is possible, and then work within the confines of those restrictions. And, you know, it stretches you as a writer, it challenges you, and, you know, you develop different muscles to use in that respect. So that was an eye-opener for me and a terrific challenge. And it created other opportunities that you don't immediately see until you start realizing and really getting into the world that you're in. And that's what happened. I really felt that I, and I don't want people saying, oh, God, this guy needs to go see a psychologist. I really felt that I was on the moon. When you get so engrossed in your environment, you have to, at least for me, I just get completely in it. I'm there, and I'm feeling it, and I'm experiencing it. And I remember when I wrote The Lost Codex, which takes place, a large section of it takes place in France, Paris, for the most part. And it took me 3 weeks to write those chapters, that section of the book. And when I was done, I said to my wife, I feel like I had just, I just spent 3 weeks in Paris. And she said, you're nuts. But I really did feel like I had been back there, because obviously I went there to research it. But I felt like I had spent 3 weeks in Paris, because you get so deeply engrossed in it. And here I was again, you know, only not any place on Earth. I you know, was writing about the moon for half the book. So I really do feel like I know that place, the setting where the Dark Side of the Moon is set. And as strange as it sounds, and, you know, part of it was that I was not setting out to write science fiction. I wanted to ground the book, in fact, using technology that we have today. So that, you know, my readers don't pick up my book expecting to read science fiction. It's not a world in which my characters live. You know, the OPSEC team, they're covert ops operatives that work on Earth. And that's part of what made The Dark Side of the Moon so unusual and fresh, is that I don't think anybody's written a special forces mission on the moon. It, and so for me, it was keep it grounded in reality using technology that NASA and the third-party companies have, and make it so that this could happen today, not 5 years in the future, 3 years in the future. What could happen today? So I had to research things and make sure that what I was saying was accurate. You know, I ended up working with the engineers who were in charge of the Orion system, which is real. That's what NASA has been testing for many years, to go to Mars, back to the moon. I worked with people who gave me the specs on the lunar rover that they were developing in the previous iteration of Orion, which was called Constellation. They changed the name, I don't know, several years ago during the Obama administration. And I got the plans for this rover and photos of the prototype. So what I'm writing about in terms of the lunar rover on in Dark Side of the Moon is the actual prototype that they were testing out in the California desert.
Yeah, the one with the 12 wheels. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, it, cool. It was very cool. But again, I wanted to make sure that this book was approachable to fiction readers who read standard thrillers, mystery, suspense, but also because of the nature of the storyline and the setting, it also appeals to the sci-fi crowd.
Oh, absolutely. And,
I just, you know, because I grew up on Star Trek, so, you know, it's near and dear to my heart. But again, you know, I took special care to make sure that this was something that the average thriller, suspense, mystery reader could find approachable, believable, and grounded in what they enjoy.
In fact, let me pass on a compliment that I found on the website from one of the people you consulted. It said, Alan Jacobson takes fiction writing to a new level by reaching out to dozens of professionals in the field to help him formulate his story. Well, we knew that already. But he adds this, as an expert on lunar geology and having been a lunar processor and researcher of the Apollo lunar samples at NASA, JSC, I found Dark Side of the Moon plausible, well-crafted, exciting, and incredible preview of what's on the horizon. That's Charles Galindo Jr., planetary scientist for NASA contractor Lockheed Martin, retired. I love that. You nailed it, apparently.
Yes, it was. There were a few key people. You know, I had a lot of contacts and research experts that helped me along the way. I mean, there were more than a few. There were a lot that really helped me tremendously. Mm-hmm. But a few of them came from, one of those amazing stories of being in the right place at the right time, in front of the right people, and just asking a bizarre question and getting the answer that you needed. And here's one of those. We were at dinner, my wife and I were at dinner with friends in Los Angeles, and he's a real estate developer and she is a travel agent. So there would be no reason for me to say to them, you guys know any astronauts? But I did. And one of them said, Josh said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. And then his wife, Debbie, said, and I know somebody who works at NASA in some capacity that I can't remember. And she looked it up and connected me with him. And then he connected me with the astronaut, which how he met the astronaut was one of these, you know, strange situations where he was on a plane flight to Washington, D.C. and sat next to this guy and they started talking. This guy was a space shuttle astronaut and he was running for Congress. So, you know, they started talking and he kept his contact information and so he connected me with the astronaut. And so I go to his, now taking this another step, mm-hmm. of how can this be possible, but it is. He was in Stockton, which is about an hour's drive, give or take, hour and a half for me. And it was like, wow, you know, can that be any more convenient? Not only is he the expert that I need to speak with, but he's, you know, a car's trip away. So I go to his office. And I walk in, and there's they put me in a conference room, and there are two people discussing something that, you know, had nothing to do with space or engineering or anything like that. It was dealing with their website. And, you know, I introduced myself. We chatted for a few seconds, and that was it. And then, you know, the assistant came in and took me to meet with the astronaut. So I'm talking with Jose, and we spend an hour together going through my storyline, and he's correcting me along the way, saying, okay, well, we wouldn't do it that way, we would do it this way, and this is how we did this, and okay, this is, you know, to change this to this, and hey, you know, Russia has that, and, you know, so he was enormously helpful and really helped me set forth the storyline and get rid of the things before I even got too far into it, get rid of the things that were just not right factually. And so that was very helpful. And then I said to him, you know, I really need a lunar geologist. Do you know any? And here's the amazing thing. He goes, yeah, you know, the guy who was in here when you came in, he worked on the moon rocks, the actual moon rocks, you know, with NASA. And it was like, what? You know, what are the odds and what is the luck? And so he said, yeah, I'll bring Charlie back in. So Charlie came in and spent over an hour with me going through the details of what I needed to know on a base level relative to the storyline that I had constructed dealing with the moon and the geology of it, which plays a, I don't want to give too much away, but it plays a key role in the story. So he was enormously beneficial. And then, you know, follow-up emails to make sure that the information that I was putting forth was accurate. And I gave it to him when I was all done. And I said, okay, you know, have at it. If there's anything that I screwed up along the way, let me know. And he was like, man, you nailed it. So that was awesome. And then there was another individual at Rocketdyne, Aerojet Rocketdyne, Kent Wong, who, amazingly, I've known Kent casually for 30 years. And his wife and my wife went to camp together as kids. So, you know, I knew his wife more than him. But my wife was up in Sacramento, and they were having lunch. And I don't know how it came up, but it came up that Kent was at Aerojet. And so when my wife told me that, I went, oh, my goodness, I wonder if he'd be able to help me. And I contacted him, and not just help me, but he was instrumental in helping me understand a lot of the rocketry concepts in terms of both the current day, because they Aerojet works on parts of the Orion system, which is what I was using for my characters to get to the moon.
Right.
And plus he had worked on the space shuttle engines, which are being used. And in addition, he was a fan, as I guess most space-related experts are, of the Apollo missions. So he knew everything that I needed to know. And it was just, you know, one of these amazing things. And you can't, you know, it was serendipity. It's just, it was terrific. And I couldn't have written it with the veracity that I did without these people. And there were more. I mean, there was a robotics expert at Carnegie Mellon. He's a professor of robotics, and I'm not doing it justice. I think he's head of the department there, of the robotics department, and he's built these robots that are going to go to Mars and roam the surface and get information. And I have an issue in Dark Side of the Moon where I needed that kind of information relative to certain equipment. And again, I'm trying to be a little circumspect so I don't give away anything in Dark Side of the Moon. But he and his, at the time, research assistant, and now she's, you know, got her PhD, and she's now a professor in the robotics department there. And they were both very, very helpful in helping me understand. It was like I was a student, and they were teaching me on a, you know, an approachable level as to how this all needed to work. And because I needed to understand how it worked to translate it into the story conventions that I needed to write for my readers. So, you know, it's taking a crash course in robotics and solar technology and all that to be able to translate it into thriller, mystery, suspense conventions.
Well, you have to know what you want to go wrong. It has to be logical and plausible, and what you have to do to fix it has to be logical and plausible. So, yeah. Boy, there's so many places that the basic shape of the plot is that we're going back to the moon. We have competitors. Then the life on Earth is at stake, I think, is right. Not too, yeah. So it gets very, very, very complicated very quickly. Again, this was one of those, and I have the copy that's in the giant comb-bound, very large book, and I was flipping through those pages like nothing. It was ripped through this right now because I have to know what happens next. And again, that's one of your gifts there that you have. I do want to comment on one thing that might be a bit of a spoiler, but I think it's a game changer, having to do with a technology that allows you not to take zillions of spare parts with you when you go.
Yes. Yes. So I learned, you're talking about 3D printing, and at the time that I started researching it, I knew about 3D printing because I had seen one working. I walked into a Microsoft store about 2 years ago, and they had a 3D printer there right at the desk, and it was printing a plastic part. So I was intrigued at that point because, you know, when you think of printing, it's like, well, how is that printing? But then you get it. It is printing, and it's just printing it in three dimensions.
Right.
And I started doing some research on it because I was interested in it, what its uses were and what it could be used for. Fast forward now to when I'm researching Dark Side of the Moon, and I had gotten a tour of the SpaceX factory floor, which I thought I was just meeting with someone at SpaceX to help me with the research, and he came and got me in the lobby, and the doors parted just like in Star Trek. You know, you have these giant doors that walk up and they part, and then they close behind you. And I'm on a factory floor, and he starts, you know, walking me through this thing. And I said, "Where are we?" He goes, "This is the factory floor. This is where SpaceX builds all its rockets, its engines, everything. This is it. This is our only factory." And it was like amazing because we walked right up to this 3D printer that was not printing plastic parts, but metal parts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing to see, you know, I'm holding this part, which is, you know, heavy and it's big. And it's just amazing that this was printed in a tabletop printer.
Yeah.
And so I asked about if they would use this in space. And he goes, "Yes, absolutely. In fact, it's being used now on the International Space Station." So I then said, okay, I said to myself, this is something I need to use in my story because this gives me tremendous flexibility, because then you're not, one thing that I learned as I started to do the research is that every ounce is accounted for.
Oh, yeah.
When you blast off, because a launch, you know, again, this gets into such technicalities that I didn't even go into in the novel, but, you know, the thrust of a rocket, the power of a rocket, everything is calculated very precisely so that you have enough thrust to get through the gravity, through the atmosphere, and then, you know, on its way to the moon and or Mars, whatever it may be that you're going to. So everything has to be accounted for in terms of weight. And that means that if you don't take something with you, you don't have it later to use, mm-hmm. should you need it. And if your characters are faced with the unknown and threats and challenges, you either brought something with you or you didn't. You can improvise just so much, but, you know, there's a limit to what you have with you. And it's not like you could walk around and say, "Oh, I'll pick up some sticks and I'll build it." No, the moon, there's not a whole lot there. So the 3D printer and that technology enabled me to use something real that is, as I came to learn, it is being incorporated into space flight, because when we do get to Mars, they are going to be using 3D printers and raw materials found on the surface to help construct walls and habitats to use. So this is a technology that is being incorporated into plans for these types of endeavors. And I used it in my novel. It was just perfect.
There's, I'm thinking about the scenes in Apollo 13. Well, the engineers on the ground found the ways to use the whatever stuff they had in the capsule at the time to jury-rig stuff. But with a 3D printer, you can fill. You don't have to carry racks of parts. You just carry the raw material, the printer, and make only the parts you need instead of carrying zillions of parts you never get a chance to use. So it's like the concept when it's time to railroad, you railroad. When it's time to be sophisticated about space travel, you have a 3D printer.
Exactly. I mean, it provides, you know, if you look back to, I don't even know, 10 years ago, and the concept of going to another planet was sci-fi. It was like, gee, that would be wonderful someday if we could do that. And there were people working on it, but you couldn't get past the issues of, okay, when you get there, how are you going to stay there? Because you have to build a habitat. You want, you know, a laboratory to do research. You want to have oxygen and food and, you know, facilities to use. And those problems had not been worked out. I mean, they had talked about various different ways of tackling that. And they found ways of doing it, but the cost was just astronomical. However, now, when you factor in the 3D technology, the cost has plummeted to the point where there are multiple countries talking about having the ability to set up bases on the moon. And these are not any of the major companies like we know them. I mean, countries. Mm-hmm. You know, India has been talking about doing that. And, you know, that's for that to happen, you need often the kind of technology that can make that possible.
Yeah.
And, so 3D printing is that kind of technology.
And I bring it up just to show one aspect of just how complex and satisfying, I think is the word I would use for this, for the reader, because it goes in all directions at once. Now, and again, there's a certain part of you that, as an author, is a sadist, because you do treat some of your characters pretty badly through this. And as I hear you enjoying yourself right there. But the stresses and the strains and the solutions are just really engaging in every sense of the word. So at one point, without going too much, relatives are threatened. And it's always easy to be a hero for yourself, but it's really hard to sacrifice someone else. That's a very different proposition.
You know, at the end of the day, we talk about the technology and the materials that these companies, including NASA, are using to get us to the moon or even, you know, Mars, but relative dark side of the moon, to the moon and back. But at the end of the day, this is a story about relationships and people and the ability to survive and the emotions involved in doing what you can to protect your country, your world. And this was one opportunity that I had to keep the emotional impact intact in the novel. And yes, there's a loved one threatened and choices have to be made. And, you know, it's not unlike the choices that those in our military are forced to make at times. And, you know, I hope people understand that, you know, when we send people off to battle, there's real people involved in these things, and it impacts not just the individual who's landing in a hostile environment, trying to protect our freedoms, but the families that go along with that, and lives are forever changed. And so at the end of the day, that's what my novels have to be about. And, you know, that's how you get the connection with the reader, is the emotional connection of the characters, the individuals, their families. They even become families to us. We read a novel in a series, and it's fun visiting with these people.
Yeah.
It's fun for me visiting with them for a year at a time when I write these novels. I sounds weird, but it is what I do.
I've got a couple of quotes I'd like to wind up with, because I think they really sang to me as I was reading it. One, you quote Jackie Robinson as saying, "A life is not important except on the impact it has on other lives." And that seems to resonate throughout the book as well.
Yeah, and I feel that way myself as well.
And then there's just a little short back and forth between a couple of the characters, and I'm just going to read, it's very, very short. It says, "We've done some, I'm going to change a word here, crummy and boneheaded things all over the world." And the other character says, "But never out of malice." Huge difference. "We don't plan to take over the world. We don't invade or bully other countries. We don't claim or steal others' land or resources. Some countries, they don't have such nonviolent goals." And again, that was, it's just a little piece, but it kind of reaffirms where we are, what we're doing, and why we're doing it.
Yes, I stay very plugged into current events, and always have. And I like to write things that allow my reader to think. You could just read my books as a straight thriller or suspense or mystery novel, but there's depth to it if you want it. It's there.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are ways in thrillers to get points across, to have thoughtful discussions and discourse amongst characters, tackling issues that we tackle as a society globally nowadays. And I it's not like I'm forcing it in. It's just naturally occurring out of the situations that my characters find themselves in. And I think that's okay. I think it adds depth to the character. If you are the type of person that likes to ponder things, it gives you food for thought. It's the same as humor. I find that humor finds its way into my stories. Even though, you know, you could be in one of these thriller environments where seconds count and lives are in the balance, that doesn't mean a character can't say something funny. I mean, it just, I love that. I don't try to do it. It just kind of comes. And there are times when I read my novels, you know, I'll pick up one of them off my shelf and I'll just open it up to a random page and I'll start reading. And I laugh. And that's good, you know, because it's funny. The characters are just terrific together. There's this great chemistry. And they make these wisecracks. And I just, you know, it makes it fun for me to write. And I certainly hope it makes it fun for my readers to read.
Oh, I think you have. I think we probably ought to wind it up because we've taken much of your time. But I do want to say that Alan Jacobson is a cool guy. The Dark Side of the Moon is an amazing book. If you want an autograph copy, for gosh sakes, contact VJ Books. And I really look forward to the next one, which I'm sure is coming down the pike already.
Yes, it is, as a matter of fact, Roger. Thanks so much. This was you always have such terrific, insightful questions.
All right. Our guest, Alan Jacobson, thanks so much. And again, VJ Books is the place to go to get all of his signed autographed first editions. Thanks again, and keep up the excellent work. Thank you.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you for listening to Modern Sign Books. Make sure to follow and comment on who you would like to hear next. Feel free to check out our other author interviews. And visit vjbooks.com to pick up signed copies of all of your favorite books.